welcome to the Happy Hour. I'm your host, Tony Yang, and today with me, just Clark Price. Our good buddy, Alex Cortez, is taking a little time off, a little mental health and well-being check, and hopefully he'll be back with us next week, just kind of taking some well-deserved mental break away from, from thinking about heady issues. How are you doing, Clark?
I'm okay. I think that it's a very unsteady time, and there's a lot of variables in the air, and I think I and the majority of America felt very confident for the majority of their lives. I mean, I'm going to say for my entire conscious life that our elections in this country were stable, and that they were reliable and honest. And for the first time, we have a situation that, due to what I would say is the aberrant personality of the President of the United States, the sanctity of the vote and elections and democracy itself is now made subordinate to his political ambitions and his, I think, just need to have and hold power indefinitely in the manner of a lot of the people that he seems to admire, the people who act as totalitarian leaders in their countries. And I would say that would be going from Erdogan to Kim Jong Un in North Korea, to Putin, of course, to Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. Who's the guy in Romania?
I don't remember.
Yeah, so they're all over the place, and I think we're in a very dangerous time, and it's basically due to this one person, but also behind him is a party that's been coming off the rails for decades now, and fueled by a media, Fox News, which I think is very, very destructive as well, and has done more to damage this country, and I think Rupert Murdoch is responsible, than any other single entity.
I mean, I think things are, they've reached a tipping point. I'm just not sure which way things are going to tip, right?
That's what a tipping point is.
But that's what's scary. I mean, generally speaking, we know during a tipping point when we've arrived at that tipping point, but we also generally know which way it's going to tip. I think in history, if you take a look at the landmark elections that happened, 1980 wasn't a surprise that Republicans and Ronald Reagan were going to do well. The nation had been saddled by this terrible tragedy of the Iranian hostage crisis. In 1968, we knew that Americans voted for law and order. I mean, that was a tipping point. I think that the closest thing in sort of modern U.S. history, I would have to go back to the Depression. I would have to think this is 1932. But even this is even more uncertain than 1932. In 1932, we knew Hoover was going to get booted out of office, and we know for whom. It was just the matter of what the final vote count was going to be. And so I don't know, unlike this one, if there's been a normal time.
If the election was working correctly, we would know that Trump will be defeated.
Right.
And that Biden, who I consider to be not the greatest candidate and not a visionary by any means, and wrong. And he's had been around for many decades, actually, and nearly five decades, and he's made a lot of mistakes during that time. So where will he go and what will he do as nearly an octogenarian in office, having defeated probably the worst? This is assuming that the vote actually is counted properly, because the schemes that they have afoot are remarkable, and including throwing the whole election into the states, in which Trump would win if that happened, sending their own slate of electors to the Electoral College. Trump sending his own slate of electors, I should say. This is an unprecedented time where we have the president of the United States with all the capacity, the hands on the levers of power, to do a great deal of damage to our democracy. And it looks like he's absolutely intent on doing it with the pretext, or under the pretext, that the vote is somehow corrupted and cannot be trusted. And so therefore, his assumption of victory can be trusted, and he can simply take the election himself. So I think, you know, and were he to do that, I think you would see the stock market drop out of it, because the stability of the U.S. dollar and the U.S. system is what attracts investments to the United States, number one. Number two, you have to, and I'm doing the Joe Biden thing of enumerating things, but you have to actually have faith in the system that it's going to be honestly accounted, that when you invest in the stock market, that your money is going to be honestly handled and taken care of. With this guy as president, nothing can be trusted. Not any institution of business or government can be trusted, because he set the standard for, there's no president that's ever lied this much. 20,000 plus documented lies on material subjects. So I think an authoritarian rule of Donald Trump over the United States of America, the first thing that happens is we're not the United States anymore. We're some kind of controlled enterprise of the mind of a lunatic hotelier named Donald Trump, who shouldn't have anything to do with anything. So I think you'll see general strikes, all kinds of unrest, and then he'll respond the way tyrants do to what all of that. And then I think the military will be obligated to get involved, and chaos will ensue, because what else is this guy ever capable of? And Sic Semper Tyrannis is will be the end result. And so one way or another, something's going to give, and either he's going to end up in prison or... And then there's another issue, which is everybody's got COVID. He's given COVID. He's patient zero in a massive infection of COVID in the Republican Party, which extends to Riverside, because that guy that runs that mega church in Riverside.
Right, Greg Laurie.
Yeah, what is it? Calvary or something? What is it called?
Harvest Church.
Harvest, yeah. Yeah.
Greg Laurie, yeah. Who runs the giant Harvest Crusades throughout Southern California.
So he's an endangered species because of his age, along with, most of these guys are 65 and over. And so if they've got comorbidities, and that's what happens when you get older, things start to fail. And so I think it's just problems all over, contributing to, I think, an entirely appropriate sense of being very, very unsettled. So ask me, in answering your question, that's how I feel. How long did it take to answer that? It's probably 15 minutes.
Well,
so something else happened.
Like I said, it does take 15 minutes for sometimes to, look, there's a literal wall of lies right now. There's a wall of lies in Brooklyn,
Trump,
New York.
Trump did build the wall.
And so all I can say is there's all of that. The only sort of a hope I have is that the fact that he got COVID and has spread COVID all around has actually created a scenario between that and how he acted in the debate. A realistic scenario where people have just been turned off. Like, what would have been a big Democratic win now seems like it's headed there, headed to a much larger win. I think it was even today, John Cornyn said was getting very vocal about the president's behavior, the senator from Texas, chastising him about how irresponsible this administration has been. Now, he's not going to vote for Joe Biden, I give you that. But at the same time, I don't think we're reaching a tipping point in where I think if the polls keep going this way, I mean, you see the CNN poll came out today, Trump down 14 points. There was another poll where he's down 15 points. You keep seeing that the next couple of weeks, there might be a tidal wave and a tsunami away from the president, at least for at least some of the Republican base, particularly those in contentious elections.
There may be. I'll just state this for the purposes of stating it, that it may be that people, that Trump is so it may be the case that people will vote for Trump but are too embarrassed to say that they would. And so that, because people that are Trump supporters, when Trump said he could murder someone on Fifth Avenue and his supporters would still support him, he was not lying. And he wasn't making it up. That's one of the few things that he told the truth about, because he has a cult-like hold over his supporters. There are people who go to his rallies and have gone to dozens of them, or quite a few dozen of them. I guess I'm going to guess they're retired, because how could you have a job and do that? But these are like a version of deadheads who would go see the Grateful Dead, play wherever they were going to play, except these people, I would say, are in a death cult, and it's the Trump death cult.
I was going to say the deadheads were much more benign.
Oh, much more. Yeah.
They were, puff, puff, give. They were, puff, puff, they, give.
Yeah. Or pass. I think
that's puff, the, puff, the, pass. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think that we're in a load of trouble here. And as Shakespeare said, when trouble comes, I can't remember now. I just blanked out. It said that it comes in droves. So, and it does seem that way in life, that often troubles just pile up, and that's happening now to the United States. And it's that pile of troubles that's causing whatever it is that tips at the tipping point to start tipping. So we're dealing with that. Anyway, something else happened in the news today. It was announced that Eddie Van Halen died.
Right.
You asked me before the show if I had ever had any meetings with Eddie Van Halen, and I did.
So let's hear it. Is it a good story? All right. Is it funny? Is it?
I was in the music industry in the 1980s, and in that time, there was a time when I put together. I did a recording that was pretty successful with an artist. It was just mostly the two of us working in a studio and with some other musicians brought in. And so what we did was to try to put together a band to tour this album, which had come out. It was released in 1986. And I'm not sure what's happening here. Oh, okay. Anyway, so we rented a rehearsal studio. And it was the exact city, I can't remember, but it was in the San Fernando Valley. And it's a very famous rehearsal studio. It's called Leeds Rehearsal Studio. I'm sure it's still there. Anyway, a lot of bands would rehearse there. And it was very high end. It was very comfortable and luxurious. And they had different kinds of rooms there. And they had, if you were doing a club tour, they had a room made up to look like it was a nightclub. And so it had a stage that would be appropriate to a nightclub. I would say a stage like the House of Blues, if you've been there. So
right,
it was like,
right.
It wasn't small. It was like a nice club you would play at. So you would gauge what kind of thing you were probably going to tour. And then you, in a situation like this, you would probably had a tour all booked up or mostly booked. So you'd know where you were going to play. And so you select the room. So they had various stages of in there. And however, there were only two acts that were in this entire facility rehearsing. And there was us with the club tour. And then there was the arena stage, which was a huge stage like you would see at a festival or a giant, like a basketball arena or something that it was being utilized for a rock show of the classic sort. And in that room, I heard some of those riffs coming out of that room. And I thought, that's not, because I didn't know who was going to, I didn't know who was in the giant room. But that was the band Van Halen featuring Sammy Hagar as the singer. And the thing that I noticed when, first of all, the reason that a star is a star is because when you see them, they are all on. They're dressed up and all this other stuff, and they spend a lot of time in rehearsal studios perfecting their show. So what you get to hear, if you're in a rehearsal studio with a band like Van Halen, which, by the way, I did not like Van Halen. I was not a fan of Van Halen. I thought the music, and this will sound really blasphemous, but I thought the music was dumb. I hated the song Jump. I could see Jump.
That wasn't edgy. That wasn't innovative,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think they did the song Hot for Teacher with David Lee Roth. Is that right? I thought that was good, if I'm remembering that correctly. But my favorite song with of Van Halen's was Running with the Devil. I liked that song. And but otherwise, and then they did a cover of Pretty Woman Walking Down the Street, Pretty Woman, kind of liked it. I hated that. I thought that was a horrible.
I do remember that one. That one was
a
not
a horrible cover song.
I'm not a Van Halen fan, so I mean,
and so I think that people will realize that this is a true story, because most people would say, "I loved whoever it was they're talking about, and I met him, and it was just a dream come true." I had no interest whatsoever in meeting Eddie Van Halen or anyone in Eddie Van Halen or any the band Van Halen. And so I just happened to be there. And then there's a number of things I remember. Their rehearsal of the song, Pretty Woman, it was really weird. As Eddie Van Halen's trying to figure out this really simple opening riff of and he's messing it up, and then he gets it right. You heard his songs, and we had our own work to do, so I wasn't listening carefully, but I'd go in and out, and they had a snack room there. I'd go in and out, and I'd hear the songs taking shape. And then there was a time when I came out, I had auditioned a lot of musicians and tried to pull some stuff together. And with the person who was my partner at the time. And it was like, we needed a break, because slogging through a bunch of musicians, some of whom are nuts, to try to find the right person to go on, to be stuck in a van or a bus on a road trip with, this is these important work, and careful decisions have to be made. And we were at a very formative stage on the stage. Anyway, it was a time to take a break. We took a break, and we went out to the break room, where they had like tables that were like picnic tables, like wooden tables in there. And then they had vending machines. So we went in there, and Van Halen, all of them were in there. So I'm 6'1", and it seemed to me that I was towering over every member of Van Halen. And so that's one memory that I had, that they were not the tallest gentleman that I had seen.
So I have this question.
Yeah.
In that, did you know it was Van Halen when you first like arrived there?
When I heard the music, I went, you don't know if that's actually Van Halen playing or somebody playing like Van Halen. Right. And but eventually it was like, I think it was actually the song Pretty Woman, because it was a lot of metally sounding stuff. And then somebody's playing Pretty Woman. I went, what the hell? That's got to be Van Halen. So then I went out into, there's a closed off secure parking area there. And there were three Ferraris there, all of them black. And there was a Ferrari 246 Dino, that, which is, you know, somebody had good taste. There was a 400 V12 there. And there was something else. I'm not remembering it. And then there was a black tour bus, all blacked out, parked out on the street. That's the bus that Sammy Hagar was apparently arrived in. He arrived in an entirely fitted bus. And so
to be a rock god in the 80s,
that's the whole thing. Rock star was really a thing. Because if you made money as a rock star in that period, before, what was that Napster. Napster was
right all the way up to the late 90s, right? All the way up to the late 90s.
Yeah. So Napster was a big thing. And then, of course, I think, you know, everything has cratered. The record companies, the whole business enterprise has cratered subsequently. But these were real rock stars. And I'll tell you, another group that I had some closeness to was the Police. And they were even bigger than Van Halen.
Well, they also hated each other.
Oh, I didn't know nothing about that. I mean, I'm sure
just
that
there, was enough,
there was enough hatred in the Police within the members of the band to go around. And that is something that happens in the business. And it certainly happened to me, in terms of my own relationships in the music industry. So,
So what was the food?
Let me get to the point of so I'm not a fan at all. Although I did notice that Eddie Van Halen could play the guitar pretty well. I did take note of that prior to this meeting. Anyway, it was in that break room that there were pleasantries exchanged. And one thing about me is I can't stand people who fawn over a celebrity, and I don't do it at all. And so my thing is to just be me. And so I say, hey, what's up? Hey, nothing, man. How you doing? And it was these guys who I was prejudiced against them when I went into that room, because I just thought, you know, that their music was lame and all this other stuff. They were absolutely charming, and they could really play, and they were real musicians who really had refined their craft. They were total gentlemen, and Eddie Van Halen, I would say, had a unique look about him, which may have been that I'm Dutch, he's Dutch, but he had a Dutch Indonesian mother. So he was half Asian and half European. So he had an interesting, different about him. And I also think that he had a real charisma that was unique to him. So my impressions were, I completely, you know, there's a thing that you have if you're active in the industry in a kind of a pop music sense. And that is like, who are the cool people and who aren't the cool people? And the cool people are lame. the uncool people are lame, and you can't hang out with them. You have to be with it. And Eddie Van Halen and Van Halen wasn't cool because they weren't in the scene that I was in. But I was a naive person, and I was immature, very immature in a lot of ways. And that experience helped me just go, you know what? Somebody is a famous star, successful, wealthy. Guess what? They're still human, and they have recognizably human. They communicate like human beings do. They have personalities. They have, you know, fears and pleasures and all that stuff. And what happened was that this objectified image of these rock stars became personal, and I saw them as human beings, and I liked them. So they all seemed like decent people, and they sure as hell could play. And especially among them, nobody could play like Eddie Van Halen. So in the pantheon of rock stars and rock guitar players, he's way up there, and he innovated and influenced a lot of people. I personally think Jimi Hendrix is better, but
Jimi Hendrix wasn't tapping his guitar.
Well, tapping one's guitar is not the measure of good or bad.
But we're both guitar players.
A musician plays an instrument with a sense of you want to have as little space between inspiration and realization. And in the case of both Hendrix and Van Halen, they were so practiced, such masters of their technique, that they could just think or feel something and they could realize it. And it takes a lot of practice, a lifetime of practice. And my primary instrument, starting as a musician, was the piano. And I had a teacher who was a very lovely person named Lila Steffen, a very rigorous, very brilliant woman who taught me. And she said that, I want you to remember this always, that music is enough for a lifetime, but a lifetime is never enough for music. And that kind of commitment to music, which is immersive and just to put your whole life into it, is obviously what Eddie Van Halen had done. So rest in peace, and I commend him to the universe. Now he is one of the greats and always will be. So that's my experience with him.
I just want to go back to that food table. It wasn't Van Halen's food that you were eating.
No.
you weren't literally getting the scraps of Van Halen's food. Snacks.
No, although you know, it wouldn't be out of character for the post-punk kind of scene that I was in to do something like that. By the way, I don't think the punks have aged very well.
No. Well, a few have. I mean,
I would say a few as in none.
There are a couple of
Rotten from the prototypical punk band, really the Sex Pistols, and
there are a couple of punk bands there are a couple of people definitely that were in the punk scene that I think have done okay. You know, Craig Ferguson has done all right, you know, even though his punk band never went anywhere.
Ferguson, the talk show host,
right? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
But I mean, there are some people.
You could put Beto O'Rourke in there, too. I'm talking not about people who dabbled in punk, but who actually lived it as and were practitioners of the form. And
I never understood it. I never really understood it. I don't think there's a sort of realm of understanding.
On another show, I'll tell you. I can explain it all to you. You will understand it, and you will have.
I still probably won't understand it. I mean, you know, I mean, infamously in one class, this is how millennial we were in graduate school. You know, we're taking a history of rock and roll graduate seminar, and you know, the professor, who used to be a sort of punk musician / rock musician in the 80s, his band didn't go anywhere, but so he became a professor. Point blankly asked us, is like, have you guys ever done drugs? And there are 25 people in this room. No one raised their hands. I mean, I that's just a cultural shift. It's how millennial I was. Nancy Reagan may have worked her magic with the just say no to drugs thing, but it was a very different sort of lifestyle and the music that I came up with. And so,
here's my problem with a lot of musicians, that they're, because of what I just said, it takes a lot of devotion, a lot of time to become good at your instrument. And it is normally the case that this produces a person who I would describe as not being very well-rounded. And so you have, unfortunately, people who are thought of as as necessarily woke, to use an expression, an unfortunate expression of from the lexicon of cool. And it turns out, you know, that so I look a little closer and here's Van Morrison, who's an anti-vaxxer and thinks that COVID-19 is a hoax. Or how about, what's his name, the singer from the Stone Roses? He's a big anti-vaxxer who was arrested for beating his Mexican wife, and or assaulting or something like that. And I am just not, I don't want to hang out with these people, or and I don't admire them, and I'd rather that they knew something about the world. And there, I'm sure these people are out there. You know, I see Neil Young or Jackson Brown seems to be, you know, making the right protest statements and so on. So it's probably the case, and maybe they know how to cook a good meal or something. And but in most cases, I find that filmmakers are more interesting to hang out with than musicians. But I'm sure there are exceptions, and
I don't know.
There are some cases where you'll find somebody was in a band and then they went off to become, you know, a great thinker. Like there was somebody that played, oh, now I'm blanking on the name. But there are people who are academically accomplished, like Sterling Morrison of the Velvet Underground got a PhD in English literature. And, you know, there are those people who...
Actually, my most recent favorite actor turned academic, who's actually very good, is Peter Weller. Of RoboCop fame.
Oh yeah, he's an expert on Rome.
Yeah, right. He studied antiquities. Yeah. He studied antiquities. Yeah. Got his PhD at UCLA. So he's your go-to guy for antiquities. It's actually not that bad. And no, there are a number of people.
He's a sharp guy. It doesn't necessarily, you know, I have problems with actors too, but. It doesn't, it's just people. I mean, people are, but as I'm saying, in terms of music, you have to work so hard to become a virtuoso. And there are so many good players out there. Go into a guitar store in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Just do that. Yeah. If you're a guitar player and you're trying to learn, go into a guitar studio or a store in Hollywood. Listen to what's going on.
We can't right now. They got to bring this back to the theme of what we've been talking about since the show the happy hour started. We can't do that because of COVID.
Oh, that's true. But if you normally, if there's,
you're just reminding us of what we can't do.
That's right. But what it means is like you know. Behold these virtuoso players and weep.
Well, half of them can't hear anymore anyway. If you go in and talk to the Guitar Center guy, his ear is like already blown out from listening to too much Van Halen.
Maybe.
there's a lot of, you know, there's a whole generation of boomers that have hearing deficits, by the way. It's because of, you know, harder, louder, faster. That does not do good things for your ears. Is all I'm saying. But we should probably turn our attention back a little bit.
Yes. Let me just say the things that connect the things that we're going to talk about in the show, from what we have just talked about to the titanic musical virtuosity of Eddie Van Halen, to whatever it is that Trump is.
Well, I have a good connector, actually.
Well, I have one as well. I'll let you go because I've done a lot of talking.
The album that you're referring to, if your memory is correct, in 1986, where you met Eddie Van Halen, was the 5150 album.
No, I think, or was it? Was that?
Yeah, that's 1986. Is 5150 was their one of their peak albums.
Well, wait a minute. Did Sammy Hagar sing on that?
Yeah, all the tracks are written by Sammy Hagar and Eddie Van Halen.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. That's it then. Yeah, that was the tour they were doing.
Yeah, it was the 5150 tour, which seems apropos because, you know, we have a president that feels like he needs to be 5150 on massive doses
of
steroids.
That's a bit of a reach, but sure.
Well, yeah, I think so he needs to be 5150.
Let me take it back to this. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal, these words appear: my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare. The lone and level sands stretch far away." That's the legacy of Donald Trump.
Is he Ozymandias?
He's the egomaniac. It says, "Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. But nothing will remain round the decay of his colossal wreck, boundless and bare." I hope it's just his memory that's the colossal wreck and not the United States.
Well, but to quote a line from The Tempest, which I was thinking about earlier today, was it "Misery acquaints a man with strange bedfellows." That's all I'm going to say. I think probably seems more apropos to the state of the nation and all the people who voted for Donald Trump.
Well, let's talk about the COVID, Trump and COVID. What are your thoughts about it?
Well, I'm more optimistic than you are. Earlier in the show, you already said that, like, you know, the election's at stake. I think it is for all the totalitarian reasons that you kind of stated that he could do. I just think it's a lot harder to do when you're down 14 points in the polls to that. And let's also keep in mind, he's not well. I mean, it was already going to be really tough for him to enact this sort of thing. It's not like he's got a ton of, you know, this is the thing. He doesn't have a particular political organization. He doesn't have a political apparatus that is so embedded in his survival, aside from his immediate circle and people like Stephen Miller, that it was going to take a huge effort on his part to try to hold that coalition together. If the COVID diagnosis works so that he's pretty sick the next couple of weeks, that's going to be pretty hard for him to sort of even make a convincing election case that it was rigged. And so I think he's having a hard time with that.
Well, you're talking about his followers. I think it will be a very easy case to make because those QAnon guys are nuts, and they're already saying that somebody did this to Trump deliberately, and so he's a victim of some sort of conspiracy to make him sick and all this nonsense.
Well, it is nonsense. I remember I told you back in like April, Trump's going to get it. He's flaunting all the
working hard to get it.
I mean, you have to work.
It took so long.
Well, all I can say is that, they've been working at this. You're going to be in a crowd full of 100 people. You're going to be not masking. You're not social distancing. You're not trusting people to mask. In fact, you're telling people to take off their mask. I actually think what was the most threatening thing that he did, the most dangerous thing that he did, was to take that motorcade ride where he got in the car and drove around, because there are two Secret Service guys that were in the car with him that he was putting their lives at stake just by taking him around. And Peter Weller would know the Romans. The one thing that if you were a Roman emperor that you who you didn't want to piss off was your personal bodyguards. You know, they'll think twice about taking a bullet for you.
Oh, yeah, there is that, but I don't think they're going to harm him.
But this is the thing. The detail is all exposed. People need a quarantine, right? That's 2 weeks without a lot of staff. They've evacuated like a ton of the West Wing, right, in order to handle this. Kayleigh McElhaney's not going to be on TV for 2 weeks. We got people who aren't going to be around for 2 weeks. The three senators aren't going to be around for 2 weeks, right? Even though they said we'll show up for the vote, it's like you need to isolate yourself. We don't know how much further this could spread. I mean, did you watch news footage last night of Rudy Giuliani on Fox News coughing?
Yeah, I don't think that's necessarily indicative. However,
it's not a good sign.
But you look at the whole picture of it. And in the core of it is like, what is going on here? It doesn't make any sense. And if you didn't believe it, if he really thought that there was a conspiracy to hoax the president of the United States, like this is really a hard thing to do and not something that a rational person would consider to be plausible. And then so he might still be thinking that way. And then Herman Cain dies at one of exposed apparently at one of his rallies. Doesn't this sober him up? What? And then 100,000, 200,000 people dead. He's still not wearing a mask. What the hell is going on in his mind? It's totally incoherent and nonsensical. And I mean, If he were some kind of religious fantasist, I could imagine him going, I'll be washed in the blood of the Lamb. Nothing can take me down. The Lord is on my side. I could imagine that somebody like that, but no one is more anti or irreligious, let's say, than he is. By the way, there's a person in my family who worked in a Democratic White House previously, and of his experiences, now he's retired, and he told me about how the intelligence services work when they turn someone to their purposes, and they look for people who are weak, who have financial problems. They look for pride and ego issues, and they look for decadence that they can exploit. And every single one of those things applies to Donald Trump. And if he was recruited by the Russians, which I think is quite possible, they did it for every single one of those reasons and through those avenues. And I think what you're seeing now in the terms of the desperation of Donald Trump is he's caught between Scylla and Charybdis. The Russians know a lot about him. And his utility to them is that he is the president. And so as president, he remains valuable to the Russians. Also as president, he's out of the reach of the United States justice system. And so on one side, he has his Russian masters. On the other side, he has the law of the United States of America. And I think the desperation and fear, you can see the fear in his eyes. Is I'm losing. And then top on that is like bringing down the Trump name. He is so in debt that the Trump empire cannot possibly sustain. Also, his family and Melania have to be looking at this and saying, you mean we don't actually own anything, Donald? And so all this whole world is collapsing, how when a star goes supernova and then the gravitational forces bring it back in and it forms into a black hole of super compressed mass. And he is about ready to be. I mean, I would say that this case is Shakespearean in terms of it's another allusion to Shakespeare. But I don't know that Shakespeare certainly, as the Greeks did, talked about the pitfalls of hubris. But on this level, and so he's making an effort to try to salvage it and to try to actually take over the presidency. And then to just grab it and steal it. And I think there is a chance that he can do that. But I think you point out, and like, he is sick and his people are sick. And the Russia media has actually said, our candidate is ill. They said that. Look it up. Google it. Our candidate is ill. So the whole thing is hanging in a balance, and you say tipping point, and I think you're right. But I think it could tip not just in the one direction. It's unstable and could tip anywhere.
I think you're right about that one. I tend to be hopeful, and so I'll say it'll tip in the favor of the righteous.
That would be nice, but you know,
it's been tipping the other way for a long time, so the last couple of years. So I think he had a case for it if the election was like 4 or 5 points, but if the election is like 8, 9, 10 points in favor of Biden, there's no amount of fraud that's going to come out that's going to be with that. The fraud would have to be so pervasive, and it's not going to be. It would be so foreign to that. And
well, another thing about it is that he couldn't do it by himself. He'd have to involve a lot of Confederates. And I say that word with every meaning possible behind it. And those people would be putting their own personal freedom at risk. But I keep thinking that behind this is a very dark figure named Roger Stone, who is probably still in communication with Trump, telling him what to do. And I think that move to get up out of his hospital bed, to fly back to the White House for what looked like a restaging of Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will, in which Hitler lands in an airplane very heroically for a crowd. It looked like a restaging of that. And he comes back for that, and he's obviously unwell. He must feel that the stakes are so high that he has to make this move to show that whatever he's up to can still go forward, and because he's still viable. If he's not viable, and I mean if Donald Trump, him, the man, is not viable, the whole scheme to throw it into the House of Representatives and all that crap, that's not going to work. This is all hinging on him being viable as the leader of whatever this is that's happening, whether it's a coup of democracy or a real election or the theft of an election, subversion of democracy, whatever is happening depends on him.
And this is where I think like the COVID kind of took out a lot of that possibility, because we're looking at the next debate is what, the 15th? The earliest he could come off of quarantine is the 14th. And that's only Clark. That's only if he admits that he knew about it Wednesday night, not found out Thursday. Like the official timeline would have to change in order for that to happen, you know. And, you know, and Biden right there just today said he will not debate Donald Trump. They cannot go forward with the debate unless Trump tests negative. The real medical question is at what level are we talking about, using the Abbott lab one, or are we talking about PCR? Because he's not going to test negative with the PCR within 14 days, because that can find the most minute traces of the virus in his body.
Well, he's getting the best medical care that's possible to receive. So
if he's willing to receive it, that's the big question.
Well,
right,
he's got the remdesivir and also the clonal antibodies, which 10 people outside of a clinical trial have been used for compassionate use, so to speak. So I think every advantage has been given to him, but I think he has an unhealthy lifestyle. He's probably done more abuse than we're made aware of, and he certainly should not have been up and running around, and he did so under a lot of pressure. So, I think largely self-imposed. Anyway, the stakes are high. The game, whatever it is afoot. And our democracy in this grand experiment called the United States, which has been very successful and has been brought to this point by the fact that we have a democracy which can renew and reorient to take a new direction in the case of a failure. We lose that if we lose democracy, and the nation will take a dive. And if America has to be America, which means in its fullness, including in terms of as a nation of laws, as a nation which votes for its leaders in free, open, and honest elections.
I will also say this, you know, since we've been quoting Shakespeare and I've been quoting The Tempest all night, to end on a happy note, which is the past is what's past is prologue. And if that is true, this nation will survive. It survived the Civil War, survived the Great Depression.
You're a historian, Tony.
Yes.
If the past is prologue, it will not survive. And I mean by the past, the history of all the democracies that have gone before.
Well, eventually.
Yeah.
You know, but we should end on a happy note. What's your one happy thing for this week?
Well, I'm taking care of my mother, and she's a constant source of joy, because she's fully intact. She's not well physically, but mentally she is, and she's funny and observant and human and loving, and so I'm. This is a great burden to do this.
It is.
But
it is.
I'm also considering it as an honor. So that's happening. That's a positive.
My good thing is that you know, the smoke is finally abating somewhat, so I can get out and go for a walk. You know, and try to stretch a little bit. I mean, California's had all these wildfires, and I'm just happy that we can get a little walk in. Well, I think that's enough for today. Thank you for listening to the Happy Hour, everyone. For Clark Price, our absent colleague, Alex Cortez, thank you for listening. Goodbye.